Today's podcast is brought to you by Howie's new book, Paperboy. To order today, go to HowieCarshow.com and click on store.
Live from the Aviva Trattoria studio, it's the Grace Curley Show.
We've got to bring in a new voice, a young voice, a rising voice, Grace Curley.
You can read Grace's work in the Boston Herald and the Spectator.
Especially Grace. Grace, stand up.
Here's the millennial with the mic, Grace Curley.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Grace Curley Show. As you all know, when it comes to the circus that surrounds the former president and all of this lawfare that he's dealing with almost on a daily basis, the latest, the one that we're currently focused on, the case du jour, involves the hush money payment to Stormy Daniels. Yes, it is back in the news. And joining us to talk about this as the jury selection begins is Mark Salinas. Now, Mark is a lawyer at Silva and Salinas. Full disclosure, he did work with the Trump team in the effort to keep Trump on the ballot here in Massachusetts. So I want to start, though, with this hush money case, Mark, involving the former president. First of all, before we get into the details of it, can I ask, when it comes to jury selection, I've been reading recently about what you're allowed to ask. You're not really allowed to just come out and say, are you a supporter of Donald Trump, or ask about politics. How do these things tend to work, Mark? Are there questions that lawyers go for to try to distinguish who they think would be favorable towards their defendant or towards their client?
Yes, this is all orchestrated in advance, Grace, so that in pretrial submissions, each side will ask to be able to ask questions of the jury, things that might root out some type of bias involved in the case. Now, there are standard questions that every court uses in the different states, and in this case, they have very specific questions, which the judge is allowed to ask the jury pool. Interesting questions such as, are you a supporter of Donald Trump? Do you follow him on social media? Do you follow any anti-Trump organizations on social media? And what it's designed to do is to find out if a person has a bias that they're not going to be able to overcome to be a fair juror. That's what these questions are designed to do.
Can you give me an example of what, like, typical questions would be in a case of this nature where you have someone who's as well known as Donald Trump? You're dealing with such a high profile case. What are some questions you would expect the lawyers to ask?
Well, they're going to ask, as I said, are you following him on any social media? They can't ask you questions such as, who are you voting for in the election and anything like that that's directly political involved. But what they can ask is, are you a member of any type of organization that might be supporting a political action committee and things like that? So the judge took the script and took them from each side and said, this is what I'm going to allow and this is what I'm not going to allow. And so that's where they're at right now with it, Grace.
And how much do you think plays into where these trials are being held? We've seen in the past Trump trying to get cases moved out of certain areas that he doesn't think look favorably on him. Obviously, this is taking place in New York City. How much does that affect it? And has the Trump team tried to push back on that?
It's huge. And that's the big question, whether or not Donald Trump can get a fair trial in Manhattan, because it is going to be an overwhelmingly Democratic jury veneer. The jury pool is going to be overwhelmingly Democratic because those are the people that are living in that area. And so the courts have rejected any challenges to try to remove the case to a different jurisdiction. So that ties into the good questions you're asking, Grace, is, well, what are the purposes of these questions that we're going to be asking the jury? It's hopefully to understand and recognize that you're going to have people that have certain political views on the jury. That's always going to be the case. But we want to make sure that they don't have any bias that they cannot overcome.
Now, let's get into a few of the details involving with this case, Mark, if you don't mind. So Jonathan Turley wrote, it's a misdemeanor under state law that had already expired under the statute of limitations. Mark, can you walk us through how unusual it is for a case like this to be brought at all?
I think it's the first time we've ever seen something like this. So
really?
You have to understand, this is a state misdemeanor charge of falsifying business records that was completely dead due to the statute of limitations, meaning that it was too old. They could not bring the case forward for a prosecution. But DA Alvin Bragg, what he did is he bootstrapped this to a federal election campaigns violation charge to get around the statute of limitations. But what's incredible about this is that the Department of Justice looked at this exact federal elections campaign violation that DA Alvin Bragg is trying to use to get around the statute of limitations and said, we're not going to prosecute it. And that's because the Department of Justice looked at it and said, you know what, they're not going to bring forward a charge that they don't think that they can win. But this didn't seem to bother Alvin Bragg at all. And so this is widely viewed as probably one of the weakest cases against Donald Trump. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. But all the legal scholars that look at this as just an incredibly outrageous charge.
And to your point, Mark, even legal scholars who, you know, tend to skew more liberal or, you know, consider themselves to be more Democrat, that this is also dealt with a lot of criticism from those folks as well. The other part of this that I wanted to get your take on is the Michael Cohen of it all. You know, what's his role in this? I'm sure when you're dealing with any sort of witness, there's always a spectrum when it comes to reliability. You know, it's hard to prove someone's credibility in life in general. I don't know how you prove that someone's telling the truth all the time. But Michael Cohen seems to be exceptionally, you know, a shady character. He was called a serial perjurer by a judge, Mark. So does anything he says in this case carry any weight?
He is the key witness for this entire case, and it's absolutely incredible that, yes, as you said, there's been a judge that's looked at him as a witness and said he's a serial perjurer. He's pled guilty himself to campaign violations and perjury charges. He's the one witness that they're going to rely upon that they need for the jury to convict Donald Trump. And you know what? You take your witnesses as you get them. You don't get to pick who your witnesses are. That's just the facts of life. But it's so rare that you're going to be putting someone on a stand that you're relying upon to convict someone that's already been convicted of being a liar. And the defense lawyers are going to be up and down Michael Cohen and painting him as just that, a liar that you cannot believe.
Yeah, and the other case that I wanted your take on, Mark, that doesn't have to do with the hush money trial. It actually has to do with January 6th defendants. And the Supreme Court is going to hear a case tomorrow. It's Fisher versus the United States that could change the legal courses for hundreds of January 6th defendants. Now, the case is asking the Supreme Court to look at the obstruction statute and whether or not it should be used to penalize these J6 defendants. Mark, what is your overall thoughts on the Supreme Court hearing this case tomorrow? And do you have any predictions on how you think this is going to play out?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, this is a common theme that we're seeing a lot of recently in the administration, that the Department of Justice is using statutes in ways they've never been used before to try to affect Donald Trump and his ability to be even on the ballot whatsoever, or in this case, how they're going to prosecute people that were involved in January 6th. So they're taking a statute that's called obstruction of justice. Great. So you can understand this charge is usually used in connection with a court proceeding or a legislative investigation where someone is shredding documents or someone is trying to influence a witness's testimony by bribing them in some way. That's the only way that this obstruction of justice charge has ever been prosecuted before. But now this Department of Justice is using it to say that if you're involved in a protest, if you were in the Capitol on that day on January 6th, that you yourself have been committing an obstruction of justice, which is a head scratcher for most people that are looking at this. They don't see the connection. And the Supreme Court's going to look at this and say, if you are using this obstruction of justice charge improperly, and that's what you're relying upon to get a conviction or a guilty plea, we're going to overturn that. And that could affect hundreds of people that were charged with crimes in connection with January 6th.
Yeah, I have a feeling if the ruling goes in favor of these January 6th defendants, we're going to be hearing a lot about this as it's kind of like a revival for the J6th scaremonger movement that we see from the left. But if it doesn't, if the Supreme Court decides to keep things the way they are, then this will just go away. We won't hear. There won't be a lot of follow-ups. Mark Salinas, I do want to ask you one more thing. I was so excited when we talked to you a couple weeks ago and you revealed that you've been following the Karen Reed case very closely. This is not just something that's taken over Massachusetts and Canton specifically. It's taken over the nation. People are following this from all over the country. Now, on Friday was the final day of court preparations. A lot of bombshells dropped, but something I wanted to ask you about as a lawyer is that Karen Reed's team, her lawyers, are making a case for a third-party culprit defense. How successful are these defenses typically when you say, you know, listen, we think that there's another theory here that needs to be heard? And what are the, how much do they have to prove? Because when you really think about it, they're just trying to prove that Karen Reed is not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Do they then have to put together a theory that the jury or the judge will buy in this case? Or do they just have to present something that plants a little seed of doubt in people's minds?
Oh, this can be a very effective strategy. So what they're going to do is try to deflect any allegations on their client and saying, look, there was somebody else involved here. Maybe someone else committed this crime and not Karen Reed. And the real interesting part about it is that they plant the seed, but then they go after all of the investigators and the state police, the people that were employed by the state police looking into this, including the officers themselves, and saying, you never explored this alternate theory. And basically what they're saying is that you focused on Karen Reed. You made up your mind that she was guilty. You built a case against Karen Reed, and you were so blinded by this that you never looked at alternative theories. And you start making this argument that the whole investigation was flawed, and for that reason that there's reasonable doubt. And all they have to do is just prove that reasonable doubt, or they have to say that the Commonwealth hasn't proven this case beyond a reasonable doubt, and that then the jury would have to acquit Karen Reed.
Yeah, and the judge in this case is considering dozens of different motions ahead of the jury selection. I'm reading now from the Boston Globe. If you had to make a prediction right now, Mark, about the next step of this case and what you think is going to happen next, what would you say? Do you think the judge is going to, do you think she's going to be open to this third-party culprit defense? There is a quote here where she said, I don't know who the third-party culprit is, even after reading 4,500 pages of discovery. So far, what's your read on this?
Well, they're going to have to make a decision on this and start in the course of the trial. If they don't do this on a pretrial motion and disclose what their theory is and ask to be able to explore it, it's going to come out in the cross-examination and the witnesses that they call. And if they are able to produce some of the evidence, right, some evidence to suggest maybe that there was a third party involved here, then the judge has to allow it in. And if it's a close call, you have to give the decision, the benefit of the doubt to the defendant in the case. And so in this case, Karen Reed's going to apparently produce some evidence that maybe there was some other individual that was involved in this that the state police didn't investigate. And if they are able to come up with that evidence, the judge has to allow it in. So it'll be interesting to see what defense theory that they take, because not all of these can all be true at the same time. They're going to have to commit to a strategy pretty soon.
And when you're dealing with something like this, Mark, I'm sorry, we're running out of time, but I do have one more question. When you're dealing with something like this, we were just talking about Trump and the jury selection, how do you find, or how do you guarantee that the people that you're putting on the jury are not following this online, don't, you know, have a relative who's very into the case? Because especially when it comes to this Karen Reed case, people have very strong opinions on both sides of it, on all sorts of theories. So how do lawyers try to root that out and make sure they're not getting someone who's totally on board with the theories or totally against them?
There's a process called voir dire, and what the lawyers do is they're able to ask questions of the jurors in writing. They fill out a questionnaire, and then based on what they answer for the questions in that questionnaire, they can then call each individual juror up and ask follow-up questions. It's a fascinating process. It's a science in itself, so that you can ask a potential juror, I saw that you said that you follow Donald Trump on Twitter.
Yes.
Why do you follow him on Twitter? How long have you? And that's how they try to get a real fair and impartial jury.
I'm blanking on the word, Mark, and I feel like a moron, but you know when they don't want a jury to talk to people, and so they put them up at hotels. Is it sequestered? Is that the word?
Yeah, you can sequester a jury. It's very rarely done.
Really? Because I would think in the Karen Reed case, they might have to.
You know, the last time that I could think of that would be the OJ trial. Remember that they put them up, they sequestered the jury. The courts are very reluctant to do that because it's brutal to take somebody away from their family, away from their job, stick them in a hotel, and then they're not allowed to, they don't give them any type of newspapers, nothing. It's almost like they're serving a sentence themselves. It's rarely done because it's so imposing upon the jurors to do that. They really don't want to do it.
Mark Salinas, thank you so much for coming on and always giving us your expertise and your theories and your wisdom. We really appreciate it. Let people know where they can find you if they have some questions of their own.
Silva and Salinas in North Andover. Website's sslawteam.com. You can follow me at Mark Salinas ESQ.
Thank you very much, sir. Nassau Beach Inn just opened reservations for spring. Jared, you stayed at the Nassau Beach Inn. I bet you wish you were driving there today. No traffic because of Marathon Monday. It's glorious outside. You can sit by the fire pits and really enjoy yourself.
Mark was just talking about how it's brutal when you're sequestered in a hotel. If I had to be sequestered, I would want to be sequestered at the Nassau Beach Inn. Nothing brutal about it. It's super cozy in the room because they have the big picture windows and the fireplace. So you can stay inside. You can be cozy. You can look out, take in all the views. The grounds around there are fantastic. Your steps from the beach, wherever you are, you can walk along the beach. Especially in the off season, you can hear the waves. You don't have to, you know, fight for a spot on the beach or anything like that.
All right, I'm writing this on my to-do list.
Get sequestered at the
Ask
Nassau
Dave
Beach.
Henchy about sequestering Jared at the Nassau Beach Inn and see if he's down.
Actually, I did get that, and I'm trying to work with Dave as well. So, the fire pits are fantastic, too. You can sit by the fire pit. You can enjoy the stars, the sunrise, the moonrise. Again, my wife and I, we still talk about how great it was to just sit there by the fire pit, drink our morning coffee, and watch the sunrise. Can't go wrong with the Nassau Beach Inn, and you can't go wrong with the value.
Yes, indeedy. Right now, you can book your April stay at the Nassau Beach Inn from $249.99 a night, and this May rates from $259.99 a night. So don't wait. Go to NassauBeachInn.com. That's NassauBeachInn.com. The Golden Gate Bridge is being basically shut down by these anti-Israel protests that are going on. We will have more information on this for you when we come back, and we'll continue to take your calls. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to The Grace Curley Show. This is The Grace Curley Show.
Scottie Scheffler came up big this weekend, won the Masters again. And you know what? He's one of those guys, he's really hard for people not to like him. Like, you know how most athletes, Jerry, even if they're nice, even if they're well-liked, there's always a contingency of people who go, I think he's a phony, I think he's whatever. He's really the real deal. Like, even when they asked him afterwards, how his wife's 9 months pregnant. There was talk that she might go into labor during the Masters, and he had said he would leave if that was the case, which obviously sparked conversations around the country between husbands and wives about what would you do if you were playing at Augusta. And when he won, he said, you know, I'm so excited to get back to my wife. He just seems like a really sweet guy. So congrats to Scotty on another win. Jared, let's do the poll question here. But first, I just want to let people know these pictures are insane. The anti-Israel protesters shutting down the Golden Gate Bridge. And I know the Golden Gate Bridge is different than, for example, the Francis Scott Key Bridge. But I don't think anybody right now in the United States of America wants to be chilling. I don't think you want to be sitting on a bridge at any point. But let alone after
Mayor
all these...
Mayor Pete's at the office. There's nothing to worry about.
Let alone with Mayor Pete at the office, with all these weird, you know, tragic accidents happening, which, by the way, they're opening up an investigation into the bridge in Baltimore. But is this really a time? Not that there's never, it's like one of those things, Jared. There's never a good time to have anti-Israel protesters.
Hey, it's Pete. I'm here at the office.
Shutting down a bridge. But I would say right now is an exceptionally bad time. Where if I'm sitting on that bridge, I'm like, okay, I'll tell you what. Can you at least let us get off of it? And then you can shut it down. But let people get off. I don't want to be in the middle of the Golden Gate Bridge just chilling there. It would make me very, very uneasy.
Sorry, the Biden administration told them they could protest on the bridge and keep the cars there as long as no ships crash into it. So,
Got it.
Minor incursions.
Minor protests. Within limits. You can shut down the bridge within limits. The poll question today is brought to you by JB Auto Care in Weymouth, Mass. Keep your car, truck, or SUV running in tip-top shape. Get $20 off an oil change, conventional or synthetic. And call today and let them know I sent you, or book online at jbautomotive.com. Bill Broussard is the best in the biz, so make sure you check him out. He's actually not like the others. You can trust him. Jared, what is the poll question, and what are the results?
Today's poll question, which you can vote in at gracecurlyshow.com, is how would you describe your concern over Middle East problems escalating? Not concerned, somewhat concerned, or very concerned?
Well, considering Joe won't even do a don't anymore, and it's somehow the best he can muster up is just don't to Iran before they launch this ballistic missile strike, I'm going to say I'm very concerned.
60% say they are very concerned. 31% say they are somewhat concerned. 9% are not concerned.
All right, Tommy, AJ, everybody on the line, just wait there. We'll take your calls when we come back.
Live from the Aviva Trattoria Studio.
Welcome back, everyone. Trump's hush money trials resuming today in NYC. Jury selection is underway, and we're going to get the ball rolling on this. It's just another case under Trump's belt that he is fighting, this lawfare. And Mark Salinas is absolutely right. From most of the response I've seen to this case, it kind of spans the political spectrum, but the legal experts are not thrilled with what they're seeing. They do not think, not only do they not think it's the strongest case, they think it's the weakest of all of the cases. Because Alvin Bragg really had to spend a lot of time and a lot of money to kind of piece together something to go after Trump with. And I think it's pretty obvious that this never, ever would have seen the light of day if it weren't Donald Trump who was involved in this. I don't think there's even a question of that. Tommy, you're up next on the Grace Curley Show. What's going on, Tommy?
I've been on hold a while, but you mentioned earlier that the Biden administration did back channels through Turkey to talk to Iran.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
That's what Reuters is reporting. I haven't seen it in a lot of other places. So hold on, Tommy. I want to give you the actual line here. So I read it in the Daily Wire, and they were reporting that Reuters said that Iran, let me just read exactly what I have. It says, Reuters reported that the Biden administration communicated to Iran through the Turkish government that its attack on Israel had to be within certain limits. Senior U.S. officials told Semaphore that the attack, which included hundreds of one-way suicide drones and missiles, was designed to cause mass casualties and infrastructure damage. Now, I should know, Tommy, the White House is denying this. They're denying that they communicated through the Turkish government to Iran that the attack had to be within certain limits. Probably, and I guess you can believe whoever you want to believe. I tend to believe Reuters over the Biden administration. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I would believe Reuters. And, you know, it's just unbelievable that, you know, with regards to media these days, sources say. But let's put it this way. As far as what Biden has done to Israel, telling them, you know, leaking it publicly that he's told Netanyahu not to retaliate, I don't understand what this obsession is with the Obama and Biden administration of giving Iran help with regards to freeing up their assets, because obviously they fund terrorism. And God forbid if Iran ever detonates a nuclear weapon. And Trump's administration was very close to getting Saudi Arabia to normalize relations with Israel, which would be huge, even if it's only business only. But, you know, I'm thoroughly convinced that the progressives in Washington, D.C. want Iran to have a nuclear weapon out of the simple fact that they think that it's all about fairness. And the mullahs in Iran have publicly said for 40-some-odd years, death to America, death to Israel. And I don't know who the black intellectual woman was that said, when somebody tells you who they are, believe it. I don't know if it was Maya Angelou or whoever, but someone said it recently about Trump or whatever, but
Let me say this, Tommy. I have two things. I have two things to say. One is that I'm really glad you brought up the leaking, because Marco Rubio, senator from Florida, he was on with Jake Tapper, and it was a very interesting interview, and there was a couple of noteworthy takeaways. But he did mention that leaking, Tommy, and he thinks it's important, too, and he thinks it's very telling. They're trying. Nobody's leaking things unless there's a motive. You know, nobody's leaking to the press or having certain information get out unless they're trying to create a narrative. And Tommy's right on that. So listen to Marco Rubio right here.
Israel is not asking us to launch attacks on Iran. I've ever heard the Israelis come to us and say, will you help us or will you attack Iran or go in after Iran? They're not asking for that. They're not asking for it. But I think we go from that to the other extreme, which is Joe Biden telling Netanyahu, take the win, don't do anything. And then his people leaking it to the media, leaking it to the press. They know that Israel's going to respond. They know this for a fact. So why would the White House leak it? There's only one reason they leaked that. And that is that so when Israel does respond, the White House can say, we told them not to do it, and at least somehow appease these so-called peace activists, these so-ceasefire now people who were out yesterday cheering the launch of hundreds of rockets and drones and missiles against Israel. People that are out there cheering military attacks of this scale and scope are not peace activists. These are anti-Semites, anti-Israel, pro-terrorist elements out there. And we need to stop calling them peace activists. They are not peace activists.
Yeah, they're shouting death to America in Dearborn. They're saying hands off Iran in Chicago yesterday. And then, Tommy, today, very busy schedule for these peace activists. Today, they're shutting down the Golden Gate Bridge, which it's never a great idea to have a bunch of people sitting on a bridge, especially right now, given the state of bridges under the Biden administration. But you're right. And the other part that you just brought up about Obama, about Joe Biden, about why they do these things is that, and I've been pushing this talking point quite a bit lately because I do think it's important to note, these protesters are mad at Joe Biden because they don't think he's anti-Israel enough. And you might say Joe Biden's not an anti-Semite because I don't think it's any sort of deep-rooted animosity he has. But he's just feckless enough that he goes along with all these Obama-era people. And if you look at the Obama administration, and Tommy was just alluding to that, they were extremely anti-Israel, they were extremely pro-Iran. And as Marco Rubio said, Bibi Netanyahu's not asking America, because Joe Biden's making it clear he's not going to help if they retaliate against Iran. But those are two options. Like, we either here's the part that always drives me crazy. These two choices we get from this administration and from the left in general. Here are our two options. We either have to partake in Israel's retaliatory, and they keep saying it's got to be proportionate. It's got to be proportionate. So because they were able to deflect 99% of the attacks, it has to be proportionate, I guess, to the missiles that landed. In Grace Curley's world, again, not a military expert, I would say let's have it be proportionate to what their original goal was. Let's look at what they wanted to happen, and let's have it be our response will be proportionate to that. But why, to get back to this point, why do our two options have to be we either, like, oh, we're not going to help Israel launch an attack on Iran, so we have to give them tens of billions of dollars. We have to unfreeze tens of billions of dollars in assets. And we have to undo all these sanctions. We have to make sure that their economy that was at one point crippled is now, you know, back to life. Why is there no, Jared, is there nothing in between those two things of like partaking in an attack on Iran and then sending them tens of billions of dollars? There's no middleman there that we could maybe, I don't know, put a couple sanctions on them, maybe send the appropriate message and show a little bit of strength. Why are these our two things we're fluctuating between? We either have to hop in this or we have to unfreeze all these billions of assets and keep our fingers crossed that they don't use it for anything nefarious, which, P.S., they've already said they plan on using it for nefarious means. They do not plan on using it for humanitarian aid. They said, we will use it for whatever we want. And if history is any guide, what they want is to attack other places, to attack Israel, to eventually, I think in their wildest dreams, attack the United States of America. There's no middle ground here. And again, to go back to Tommy, great caller, the Wall Street Journal had a piece on this, and because he was asking about, you know, what's the goal, you know, and that's really, I would say, the biggest question I get from people, and they're not asking me because they think I have the answer, but they're just asking it more in a rhetorical sense, is like, what is the end game here? Like, you're ruining the United States of America. You're not supporting Israel. You're supporting, not only is it not supporting Israel, it's worse than that. It's you're cheering on the terrorists who want to destroy Israel. And then when they check that off the list, they want to destroy America. What is the end game here? And I think to understand that, you really got to understand the Obama administration, which is why I'm bringing on Ben Weingarten in the 2 o'clock, because there's no one who has a more expansive knowledge of the Obama years than Ben Weingarten. But let me just read you a little bit here from the Wall Street Journal. Headline of this piece, Israel should not take the win against Iran. This is Walter Russell Mead. This problem has been decades in the making. George W. Bush's mismanagement in Iraq removed the one regional power capable of containing Iran on its own without building an effective replacement. Barack Obama's feckless Syria policy gave Iran its new best friend, Russia, a commanding position in the heart of the Middle East. Mr. Trump's support for the Abraham Accords and tough policies towards Iran pointed in the right direction, but were mostly a case of too little, too late, and too erratic. Mr. Biden's support for Israel is appreciated in Arab capitals as well as in Jerusalem, but his vacillations with Iran have further strengthened the Ayatollahs and undercut America's much-diminished prestige. Jake Sullivan's poorly timed foreign affairs article last October, hailing what he thought was the greatest regional stability in decades, was the cherry on the sundae of perceived intellectual incompetence by American policymakers in the region. The Washington foreign policy establishment, which former Obama staffer Ben Rhodes called the blob, has never understood the Middle East very well. Now, Ben Rhodes was like, I think he was the genius behind the Iran deal. He was the brains behind that operation. And so, yeah, this goes back a long time. Again, we'll talk to Ben Weingarten about it. AJ, you're up next on the Grace Curley Show. Go ahead, AJ.
Yep. We got to put the American first policy, just like in the economic scene. People have to be asked, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago, or the vice versa? Here, too, when it comes to national security, we got to ask the question, will you be better off and safer in America if we wait and to attack Iran once they are nuclear, or should we attack him now? Now, we got to understand that an Iran without a nuclear bomb cannot attack America very well. Although they have all the missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles in the world, their conventional weapons mean nothing in terms of attacking America. However, if they can load them with nuclear matter, then it's a different story, and they will do it. Therefore, it's brainless. It's a feckless Biden administration that is not attacking Iran.
Yeah, and I know I sound like a broken record, but when it comes to Iran, you have to think about what has worked in the past. And that AJ's right. You know, strength has worked in the past. They don't respond well to weakness, which unfortunately is kind of the face of America right now. Joe Biden is the personification of weakness. He is there's no one worse. But something I just wanted to point out is AJ said, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? I actually had this conversation with Matt Gagnon on WGIN. We were talking this morning and I thought about this because I asked somebody who's younger, Gen Z. I'm not going to call her out on the air because she's pretty moderate, but she's got a lot of friends who are liberal. And I said, do you think your friends 4 years later recognize that a lot of the issues, a lot of the, you know, infographics they were posting on Instagram and the things they were hashtagging and melting down about, that compared to what we're seeing now, it was a lot of noise. It was a lot of dramatics. It was a lot of theater. But when you compare it, does this current circumstance we're in give those people perspective? And here's where I get nervous. I get nervous in the sense that those people who were melting down 4 years ago, that is still in their minds. I don't think this sheds perspective for them. I still do think they convinced themselves at the time that it was an emergency, like that the world was ending. And if that's the reality they're in, Jared, It doesn't matter that now we can go, look at how much worse things were. Can't you see that back then that was a creation of your own mind being fed by a crazy media, hyping you up, fear-mongering, getting you to lose your mind over nothing, over mean tweets? Can you see that now? But I don't think those people can see it. I think they're so deep into it still that they look back on 4 years ago and go, yeah, things are bad now. Yeah, we're on the brink of World War III. Yeah, gas prices are high. Yeah, eggs are expensive. Yeah, the border's open. But at least Donald Trump's not in the White House. I truly think that for a huge chunk of this country, that's still the mindset.
They would rather live in their secure delusion that they were correct.
Yes.
Than admit that they, I didn't want to say that they were wrong. They were. But rather than admit that they miscalculated how bad Joe Biden would be. Or that they
let their emotions get their emotions, the better of
them. Yeah, they cannot admit that because it's about being right and thinking that, you know, you're nice to transgender people. Is more important than the actual reality of your situation.
I'm nice to transgender people.
No, I'm saying like that's their whole mentality is, you know, I'm nice. I care about these people. And, you know, I'll pay $9 for eggs as long as I feel like a good person.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? It's, you're right. It is part of it's about being right. And then I think another part of it is this is their religion now. Like people are really clinging to this hating of Donald. You know what it's like? Because we all have this. You get so addicted to your misery sometimes. I think everyone experiences this at some point. Whether you don't like somebody or you're going through a breakup, it gets addicting. Being miserable can be really addicting. And it can like feed you in a toxic way. And I think for a lot of people, Trump is that person. He's like that toxic ex-boyfriend. And I'm not saying that as a slam on Trump. I'm saying he fills that void of let's sit around and have a glass of wine and talk about how miserable we are. And that can be really, really addicting for people. 844-500-4242. Addictive, I should say, I guess. Listen up, everyone. You've waited through the cold temps in February and the rainy weather in March. Now the longer, warmer days are finally on their way. But Jared, that also means get the tissue boxes ready. It means the sneezing's back.
Yeah, it was pretty bad this weekend. I noticed my grass was growing. So I was like, oh, let me go out and take a look around. And oh boy, the allergies. I was very happy to get back inside, turn on the thunderstorm, take care of my allergies. Because the thunderstorm actually eliminates allergens and pollutants.
How does it do that?
It creates a super oxygen by ionizing the air, and that's what eliminates, the same way it eliminates odors that are in the air.
Yeah, and that's great because it does it all without any heavy lifting. You plug it in, doesn't take up a lot of floor space, doesn't make any noise, really. And it's very effective. You know, Jared, there was a day last week where it rained, and then someone made a comment to me and said, oh, it's so nice. The air feels so pure. And I thought that's exactly why they call it the thunderstorm. It purifies that air without having to, you know, bring an actual rainstorm into your home, which I don't think anybody wants. The 3-pack special is such a great deal. I want you guys to get your hands on it. You'll definitely find use for all three of these. So here's what I need you to do. Go to EdenPureDeals.com and use code GRACE3. That's EdenPureDeals.com, code GRACE3, and the number 3. Say hello to spring and goodbye to allergens. Get the 3-pack today. Don't forget the code GRACE3. We'll be right back.
The Grace Curley Show will be right back. This is the Grace Curley Show.
Wish I was a quotes person, like someone who saw a quote. And I was in a lot of plays, some Shakespeare. You think I'd remember something, but I'm not. I always mangle it. So now I try to actually just print them out. But when I was talking about how I think for a lot of people, Trump filled this void, and it wasn't a good void. It was just like a void of wanting to hate somebody or wanting to be miserable. I thought of this book I just read, and it's called The Dutch House. That's right. I read a book, and I'll be bright. This is like when I go on a run. I already talked to Jared about a run I went on this weekend. You're never going to hear the end of it. But I was reading this book. I really enjoyed it. And it was these two young people, they have a stepmother and she's awful. And it sounds like a Cinderella thing, but it really was well done. And they hate her so much and they spend their whole adult lives hating her. And they pull up to her house and they sit outside of her house and they talk about how much they hated her and all the mean things she did. And then at some point they realize that they've wasted a lot of time on this hate. And I love this quote because it reminds me of not just liberals with Trump, but you could use it in any sense. It says, we had made a fetish out of our misfortune, fallen in love with it. I was sickened to realize we'd kept it going for so long now that we had decided to stop. And I think at some point in everyone's life, you find yourself, whether you're talking bad about somebody or, you know, you're harping on some heartbreak or someone who did you wrong, you feel that you were wronged by someone. At a certain point, it's killing you more than it's killing them, and you got to let it go. But a lot of people in this country, they're just getting started with this hate, and it's not going anywhere anytime soon. Anti-Israel protesters blocking traffic. We got Ben Weingarten coming up next.